It is time for another, what is it, bi-weekly? Yes, every 2 weeks we check in with Jean-Jacques Cornish. It's part of what we do with the Johannesburg Business School right here on the podcast party, and we check in on Africanalysis, which is really our opportunity to get to grips with all the things that are happening on this very, very exciting continent of ours, and there is no shortage of news, certainly not this week. So we welcome Jean-Jacques Cornish. JJ, how are you?
Immensely well, thank you.
Good. It's nice to see you. We're not starting in Africa, but we're going to start in Turkey, which is very involved in Africa, I believe. Tell me exactly what the history and the context here is.
More and more involved in Africa, as is, you know, after the Western powers, China, Russia, Japan, all of them, but Turkey particularly, you know, wants a better place on the world stage and sees Africa as a means of doing this. And the things we need to understand about Turkey and Africa is that it's an alternative to the West. They are filling the void that many countries have created by expelling the West. And this is what we're talking about today, is the Turkey-Niger. But to go on with why Turkey is so important to Africa, or increasingly important, is defense and security. And it deals with fossil fuels and nuclear energy. It has infrastructure and construction, and Turkey is particularly strong on that. If you look around, the Turks who are in here, the Freedom-Loving People's Republic of South Africa, I'm sure 90% of them are involved in heavy-duty construction and doing very, very well at it. And then the soft power Turkey exudes is through religion, through schools, and television. Now, it was very involved in West Africa and North Africa because of the geographic proximity and also because of the religious links. But the latest is a meeting between the foreign secretary, Fidan, the defense secretary, Gulen, the energy secretary, Barak Attar, and the intelligence head, Kain, who all went to Niamey, the capital of Niger, which, as you know, hoofed out the French and the American military aides just recently. They, of course, had Abdurrahman Tiani took power there in July last year. And he went, the prime minister of Ali Zen of Turkey was... he visited Niger 2 months ago, and Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara was met with the prime minister. So you know, it's interesting that they're wanting to do more and more, and this is what they're doing. They've signed an agreement to boost energy, mining, intelligence, and defense. And from here, they're going to go on to greater things, it is hoped. But you see, Turkey, for example, has said that it will, again, Horn of Africa, very involved there. It will start drilling for oil and gas off the coast of Somalia. So that's, it tries to do practical things. And what Turkey has above the Western powers is the same thing as China and Russia, and that it doesn't pay much mind for the humanitarian conditions in the country that it is trying to close the ties with.
Right. So how do you think the entry of Turkey into this, and the fact that they're probably allied on the side of Russia and China, how do you think this ought to be responded to by the Western powers, who increasingly are losing their foothold on Africa, and there are new colonial powers coming in?
I'm wondering what the Western powers actually can do about it. Because if a country, you know, tells you to sod off, as it were, you know, what can you do if they choose new friends? We did, was it not a couple of weeks ago when we spoke about the Russians moving into the military bases that the Americans had built in Niger? One of the things, by the way, they had drone bases. You know, they were using Niger for drones to fight against the jihadis, not making enough progress to satisfy the countries, Mali as well, and Central African Republic and Burkina Faso. But one of the things all of these African countries are getting from Turkey and want from Turkey are these very strong high-powered, long-range drone. And they're fighting, you know, more and more countries. It started out with America being able to use drones and not put boots on the ground. A lot of Africans have picked up on that and are using drones more and more. I know, for example, in the Western Sahara, the Moroccans are relying on drones to fight the Western Sahara, or to try and maintain their grip on the Western Sahara. And of course, Morocco is getting those drones from Israel.
All right, so let's turn our attention back to Africa proper here, and there are quite a few things that I wanted to ask you about. One of the people whose names keeps coming up is Aliko Dangote. He is the richest man on the continent, and he's in talks apparently with Libya, which is still, as far as I can tell, an anarchy, to get more oil to his undersupplied refinery in Nigeria. So he's taking some business risks, which he obviously believes will pay off in the long run. How are those negotiations going? What do we know?
Well, we know they've started, and they've said, have Dangote, we're going to go to Angola as well. Now, let's look at this. He is the largest Nigeria is the largest producer of gas on the oil particularly on the continent, 1.5 million barrels per day. But when there's problems in Nigeria, then up comes Angola to eclipse it. So those are the two largest. And at the moment, you see what happened was Dangote, smart man, he made his money in cement and construction. But a smart man, he realizes, of course, that this absolute conundrum of Nigerians being the largest oil producers, not having to pay through the nose for petrol, because they simply couldn't refine the oil they were getting up. So he's built a $20 billion refinery that can refine 650,000 barrels a day just outside of Lagos. But he just doesn't have enough oil to maximize the use of this refinery. He's been to Brazil, he's been to the United States and bought from them, but now he's trying to go closer to home and get Libya to provide oil. When you talk about Libya, you have to say which Libya. You know, is it the Tripoli government or is it the Benghazi government? You know, when they had the summit last week on illegal migration, it was the Tripoli government that hosted it, it's the Tripoli government that gets money from the EU to stop people launching their boats from Libya to go to Italy and to other closer ports in Europe there with illegal migrants. So this is Dangote's move to get better, to maximize the use of his refinery. And very interesting to see what success he will have, if indeed Libya can provide. And certainly if I know that Angola would be very happy to sell oil to Nigeria, not only for a sense of irony, but because, you know, they would need the money.
Well, it sounds like we've got all the oil and none of the refineries. It's a ridiculous situation. I mean, I believe that petrol is hugely expensive in Nigeria, despite the fact that it is a plentiful resource.
Isn't it just that? It really is one of the great ironies, and this is one of the great ironies of Nigeria. You know, they've got it, and sometimes when people talk about oil being a curse rather than a blessing for Africa, many's the time you look at what's happening in Nigeria and you can understand that.
So let's turn our attention to something a little closer to home here. Obviously, Mozambique is not often in the news for any good things, but less so when there's something ecological to talk about. I've got friends who just got back from there, and they always comment on how beautiful it is and how lovely it is. But it's been run by an absolute, like, flat-footed government that don't seem to be able to get anything right. But there is seemingly a little bit of good news on the ecological front.
Very, very good news. Now, there's the Mabu rainforest. It's not very high. It dominates a flatland, and it, you know, doesn't rise that much above the sea. It was discovered. When we say discovered, we mean discovered by white people, essentially, only in 2004. I mean, the locals had been using it for years and years and years for firewood, for hunting. Well, that was part of the problem. But being a highland rising out from a flatland, it means that the species that were up there weren't able to move and crossbreed with those from down the way. Certainly things like lions and leopards and the big, larger animals, they were all hunted up. They were able to move. But they have found new species in the Mabu rainforest of chameleon, snake, butterfly, and possibly a fish, bat, and shrew, and even birds. And I know this bird is watching this, so I will tell you that it's the Namuli apalis, you know, which is the bird. Well, it not necessarily a new species, but one they thought was extinct, but they believe they might have found again. But what I need to discuss with you most importantly, Gareth, is dung beetles. There are 15 new species of dung beetles, and there's a very enthusiastic young researcher who showed the reporting team a bucket of his own feces. Well, that's quite an unshy thing to do. And from right. 50 meters away, these dung beetles, I hope you've had your lunch, 50 meters away, these dung beetles could smell this and came running towards it. So he was very, very enthusiastic about these new species of dung beetles. But happily, the as you say, the rather flat-footed government in Mozambique has realized the treasure they have there, and they've declared this a protected area. So they're going to allow the locals to go in and get firewood, which they have been doing through the generations. But there'll be no more hunting allowed, and visitors will be very much restricted. And hopefully they will find, you know, getting, I said maybe on some of the new species, because it takes years to determine whether this is a new species. You've got to try and try and try again. But these insects and birds and animals have generated up there and changed, and you know, for generations, it's something that the scientists are flocking to see, and it's now going to be more difficult to get there unless you're a genuine scientist with, you know, the genuine well-being of nature at your helm.
Well, it sounds pretty wild, if you'll pardon the pun, and I hope that we'll be able to see the fruits of this labor, and the fruits shouldn't include human feces, obviously. But good for these dung beetles. They must have an incredible sense of smell. I'm very glad I don't, otherwise it would be very difficult to live anywhere in, you know, modern society, because it's all you'd smell. So it shows you, you know, nature has ways of doing incredible things, and thank God there are seemingly people who also know how to look after nature, even in places like Mozambique, where you wouldn't have expected to hear a good story like this. That's some heartfelt and exciting positive news at the end of an otherwise excellent bit of useful information on Africa. Africa Analysis with JJ Cornish. Yes?
I was thinking, you know, when you spoke about not being able to live anywhere with a fine sense of smell, I hope you understand that that means even the Côte d'Azur, because who was the poet that when he went to the loo there said, not goodbye, but au revoir, as he flushed the loo, knowing that when he went swimming later, he might make acquaintance with what he had just passed.
Delightful. All right, JJ, lovely to see you again. Thank you for an excellent update. Africa Analysis is brought to you by the Johannesburg Business School, and this is JJ Cornish. And me. It's all right here on the podcast party. Make sure you subscribe, like, and all of the things that you have to so you can get all the updates as and when they happen. Thanks, sir.
All the best.